From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Online retailers have not been able to make local bookstores obsolete for lots of complicated reasons and one pretty simple one, customer service. People like getting recommendations from someone they know and trust, and studies show they like having a store to walk into and wander and browse. The online giant Amazon has apparently gotten this message. The New York Times has reported they've made a surprising pivot away from online sales. They're building bookstores. If you live here in Salt Lake City, you already have bookstores, the local type, with people to recommend a good book, which is a pretty good way of describing our show today. Our panel of experts are with us and ready to give you options for your summer reading list. So grab a pen and join us after the news.
Hi, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West. If you've always wanted to peek into the studio, we've got a bit of a treat for you today. We created a Facebook video of the show, including Doug and our guests' conversations during breaks and after the broadcast ended. So just look for Radio West on Facebook, and while you're there, we hope you'll like us and maybe even leave a review. In the meantime, thanks for listening to the podcast.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we know news programs are getting more viewers and listeners because of the turbulent political climate. Newspapers are getting more readers. In fact, people seem to be reading a little more these days. People looking for something to make sense of this very unique moment in American history. Publishers and booksellers are apparently reporting big sales on dystopian fiction. George Orwell's 1984 is flying off the shelves in some places. Booksellers are doing reasonably well these days. Generally, sales of printed books are up for the year so far. Independent booksellers are still making a comeback, and for a lot of reasons. One of them, of course, is that readers want an expert to help them go through the dozens and dozens of titles and just recommend one to take on vacation this summer. So that's what we're doing today. We've, of course, gathered our local book experts from Salt Lake City's bookstores, some of them, and we're going to be spending the rest of the hour going through as many books as we can. So let's go. Let me introduce our local panel. Ken Sanders is with us again, of course, owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City.
Glad to be here, Doug.
Welcome back. Thanks for being with us. Catherine Weller is the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks. It's at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. And Kat, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Betsy Burton, of course, back with us, co-owns this King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Welcome back to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay, so we will, of course, jump in, but anything you want to say about that idea of dystopian fiction being big this time of the year?
I love traveling around and seeing 1984, Handmaid's Tale, Brave New World, etc. at airport bookshops, for crying out loud.
It is nice. It's although interestingly, I read a piece last week about how dystopian fiction is the literature of surrender.
In the New Yorker, that piece?
It was picked up in Lit Hub, so I don't remember the actual source. But I found that to be really, really fascinating, and it's something I want to contemplate. Being a fan of certain dystopian novels, I do think it's important to remember that if we can't imagine a better future, it's going to be really hard to get there.
Yeah.
And as someone who's never been a particular fan of dystopian fiction, I find that a lot of people want to stay out of it simply because it's so dystopian right now in our world, and they'd rather escape than dive deeper into it.
Well, that was the other question. Are you finding people going in a completely different direction?
Yes.
Yeah, there is a lot of dystopia out there, and I would include to the ones that people know, people should check out It Can't Happen Here.
Sinclair Lewis.
Sinclair Lewis, which is lesser known and absolutely brilliant, and I think speaks more specifically to this time than any other dystopian novel I've seen.
Oh, I would say Animal Farm.
Okay, let's
really?
Let's jump in. All right. Okay, so Ken, I guess you're beginning the procedures today.
Okay,
yes.
Doug, you started it, this dystopian lit thing, so I'm going to go off the reservation to begin with. There's a brand new edition out of The Handmaid's Tale to go along with the TV thing, mm-hmm. Hulu, I guess. I barely know what that is because I don't own or watch a television. But I'm going to just read this paragraph from Margaret Atwood's new introduction, and this is why I like dystopian fiction. If I was to create an imaginary garden, I wanted the toads in it to be real. One of my rules was that I would not put any events into the book that had not already happened in what James Joyce called the nightmare of history, nor any technology not already available. No imaginary gizmos, no imaginary laws, no imaginary atrocities. God is in the details, they say. So is the devil. Back in 1984, when she was first working on Handmaid's Tale, the main premise seemed, even to me, fairly outrageous. Would I be able to persuade readers that the United States of America had suffered a coup that had transformed an erstwhile liberal democracy into a literal-minded theocratic dictatorship? In the book, the Constitution and Congress are no longer. The Republic of Gilead is built on a foundation of the 17th century Puritan roots that have always lain beneath the modern day America as we thought we knew. So let Margaret Atwood have the first word.
First word. She's the best.
So Handmaid's Tale you're recommending?
Highly.
Okay.
And don't forget to read the Margaret Atwood introduction. Going from one maybe Canadian curmudgeon to an American curmudgeon, Jim Harrison, although he's dead, has managed to pull off a new book about one of probably his major passions in life. It's called A Really Big Lunch, yeah. The Roving Gourmand on Food and Life. And despite this introduction by some restaurateur foodie named Mario Batali that just speaks so lovingly of what a gentle, sweet spirit Jim Harrison is, anyone that's ever spent any time around him wow. would beg to differ with that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He is a curmudgeon. He can just, not just with that fearsome visage of his, but the wandering eye and everything, he could just terrify and intimidate anyone.
Yeah.
Ask anybody
did.
That knew him. And love to do it. This new book is a loving tribute. It's got some of his best food essays he's ever written in his life. Many were published before, but in various magazines, newspapers, journals, etc. The ones I've read so far are just laugh out loud funny. Jim Harrison's
A Really Big Lunch.
A Really Big Lunch.
That's a great picture of him on the cover.
There's also a new Joe Nesbo, The Thirst Out. I would argue, along with Dennis Lehane, George Pelicanos, Carol O'Connell, and a few others, they're some of the finest genre writing, mystery writers in the world. The Thirst is the new, I've still never learned how to pronounce, Harry Hole. I really don't know how you say that in Norwegian. It's spelled Hole, H-O-L-E, and the author often makes fun of the characters meeting Harry Hole in the first place by calling him Harry Hole, or in one case, when a case takes him to Australia, the Aboriginal detective that meets him at the airport gate mispronounces his name Harry Holy, and rather than he starts to correct him, but then oh God, I don't know what else he'll come up with, so he decides to become Harry Holy for the whole series. Great new novel. Lastly,
wait, say the name again.
The Thirst by Joe Nesbo. Lastly, a woman named Anne Elizabeth Moore that I've never heard of has written a really timely book called Body Horror, Capitalism, Fear, Misogyny, and Jokes. It's a truly terrifying book, Doug. Body Horror, Anne Elizabeth Moore.
Wait, what's it about? Just say it quick.
I told you, capitalism, fear, misogyny, jokes.
All right, you did. That's
They're
true.
Terrifying essays, They're especially for a male to read them.
Great.
This book terrifies me.
Okay, good. Catherine, you're up next.
All right. My first pick is Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran, who wrote the wonderful Lost City of Z several years ago. The subtitle of this is about the Osage murders and the birth of the FBI. And we all know, sadly, the tragic story of Native American genocide, where Native Americans are pulled from their land, pulled from their traditions, and moved about to very undesirable places. Well, the Osage Indians were displaced by the Louisiana Purchase. They got moved over to Kansas, where they lived for a while, but then Kansas was deemed desirable. So they bought land in a part of Oklahoma that was deemed highly undesirable, moved down there. They managed to buy the mineral rights, too. And what they ended up with was oil and a whole bunch of it. In the 1920s, the Osage Nation was considered to have the highest per capita income in the world because they were all oil millionaires. Of course, that couldn't stand. And the first part of this book is the relocations, but also the story of a woman named Molly Burkhart, who was an Osage Indian woman whose whole family started dying mysteriously, as did several other Osage Indians. Her mother and sister died of wasting diseases. Another sister was stabbed. People were killed all about. And finally, the Osage asked the FBI and a very, very ambitious J. Edgar Hoover, who really wanted to reform the FBI and get some power, to come solve those murders. And what they found was beyond the pale, so utterly horrifying. I won't tip that, but it is just truly, truly terrible. And it deserves a special realm of hell in Native American history. This is really well written, as David Grand does. He did a lot of research. He's a very rapid writer. So great book, Killers of the Flower Moon by David Grand. Next is American Eclipse by David Baron. We're going to hear a lot about eclipses this year.
We're going to do at least one show.
I hope you do.
And we don't know which book to pick, by the way.
And there are a lot of them. Yeah. This book is set in 1878, when they finally were able to accurately predict solar eclipses. And American scientists came out west in an attempt to prove various things, including that American science was worthwhile. But there's this wonderful cast of characters here. Maria Mitchell, who was a Vassar professor of astronomy who wanted to support academic women, women in academia. Thomas Edison, who wanted to have a new kind of telescopic invention proven to be efficacious. And James Watson, who was just a totally shady planet hunter. And what David Baron, who is a former NPR science correspondent, does is much like, say, in the Garden of Beasts, or he weaves those three stories together to become one massive story. It's fantastic. It's really great reading. American Eclipse by David Baron. Lastly, I've got Michael Wallace, Western historian's new book, Best Land Under Heaven. It's about the tragic tale of the Donner Party. And this is, we know, the people who set out to conquer a wild and barbaric land and through desperation became barbarians themselves. You know, after they ate the cattle and the dogs and the shoelaces, then they ate the people. This is sad, sad recounting of history with new scholarship in it and new research. So it's well worth reading. It is an update.
Getting a lot of attention. Yeah.
It is. Michael Wallace, Best Land Under Heaven.
Kat, thank you very much. Betsy Burton.
Okay, this is the age of anxiety right now in our country, and so I picked a book that is really all about anxiety. It's by Dennis Lehane, who is a wonderful mystery writer, one of my favorite, one of Ken's. It's called Since We Fell. And when the book opens, a young woman who has been in search of her father her whole life, she doesn't know his identity, hires a detective, Brian Delacroix. He finds nothing. Years go by. She becomes a really first-rate journalist. But she suffers from anxiety, in part because of not knowing who her father is, part because of her mother. Long story. But she's in Haiti, and she's witnessing horrific things. And she's broadcasting on air, and she falls completely and utterly apart, completely apart. It's caused by anxiety, but everybody thinks that she's drunk. It goes viral. She is shamed beyond shame, which doesn't help her anxiety. Yeah. We're going to hear a scene in a minute when she has just signed her divorce papers, and she's had to drive into the city, and she barely made it. And now she has to drive back, and she doesn't think she can, and she stops in a bar thinking she knows this place. It'll be safe. Nobody will recognize her there. And so it will be okay. And so now she's in the bar, and she's about ready to go, and she sees a guy being very mean to somebody who's in the bar with her to his date. And then the woman leaves, and in this scene that we're about to hear, he wants to buy her a drink.
It's read by the actor Julia Whalen.
He pointed at her drink. You gotta finish that. Be a crime to let it go to waste. He held out his hand. I'm Landa. Actually, I'm good. He dropped his hand and turned his head to the bartender. A Patron Silva, my good man. He turned back to her. Why were you watching us? I wasn't watching you. The bartender brought his drink. He took a sip. But you were. I caught your eye. You guys were getting a little loud, and I looked up. We were loud? He smirked. Yes. Offended your sense of propriety, did it? No. She didn't correct his malapropism, but she did fail to stifle a sigh. Am I boring you? No, you seem like a nice guy, but I've got to go. He gave her a big, friendly smile. No, you don't. Have that drink. The bird was starting to flap hard now, its head and beak rising to the base of her throat. I'm going to go. Thank you. She slung her bag over her shoulder. He said, You're the woman on the news.
So she can't really escape.
So that's her worst fear, right?
Yep.
That she's going to be recognized. So at the end of this scene, he is really being hard on her. It's just horrific. And there's a voice at her left shoulder. And he says, I'm sorry I'm late. I should have come earlier. I'm really, really sorry. And she looks around and it's Brian, this detective she has not seen for 20 years. What's he doing there? Who is he? I mean, she knows who he is, but what's he doing in her life suddenly? And that is kind of the kernel of the mystery that just leaves you going the whole book. And the amazing thing about this book, A, is how bad her anxiety is, that bird fluttering in her throat, and B, how strong she is.
It's Betsy Burton. Okay, round two. Kat.
Okay, I'm moving to fiction, and I'm going to start with utopian science fiction.
Ah! Nice
we
twist.
Need some of that,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah. So this is the first one is called Walk Away. It's from Cory Doctorow, who is an internet maven. Has solid science fiction cred, writes young adult science fiction as well, but he is an idealist, and that carries through in his fiction. Walk Away is a book that describes stepping away from the constructs of society that can make it so very destructive, from confrontation, from greed, from capitalism, honestly.
But it's a novel.
But it's a novel, and that happens with these societies. It's set in the future, near future, where the world has gone to hell, of course, and there are people who have just decided to opt out of society. They're called walkaways. They simply get their stuff. They leave, and they join these communes that are built by savvy giving people in the middle of nowhere, and they create societies, which doesn't – it's not to say it's without problems. There are jealousies. There can be conflict and greed, but there are ways to resolve that, and people work on resolving those things within themselves as they are trying to create these utopian societies outside. Of course, there needs to be – conflict, and that is society always comes back in and tries to get from these people what they are creating. And what they're mostly trying to get is their sense of well-being and their sense of selves, ultimately. And ultimately, they fail. There are strong female characters in here, as there always are in Corey's books. Lots of sympathetic, intelligent writing and lots of utopian idealism about what technology can do and become. So it's called Walk Away by Cory Doctorow.
Great.
Next, I have Haruki Murakami's newest book called Men Without Women. This is interwoven stories about, you guessed it, men. Masculinity and loneliness. Lots of loneliness in here. And what men are without women. This title, as Murakami's titles always are, is referential to something else. And it's a Hemingway short story. about men without women. These weave nicely together. Some of them are stronger than others. There's a great one called Drive My Car. Again, Murakami brings in lots of music with his writings, and this is referencing a Beatles song, but it's also about a man who tries to figure out his loneliness with his hired chauffeur. Great, marvelous writing. Haruki Murakami, Men Without Women. Okay. My last book is a Michael Crichton book. We all need some escapism. And I looked at this book called Dragon Teeth, and I thought, oh, it's another Jurassic Park.
Wait, what made you think
because there's
one.
A great big dinosaur head on the front,
you
right?
Were drawn in by the cover?
There's a big dinosaur head, yeah. And it has the same colors as the paperback. It's very consciously calls out to Jurassic Park. Yep. But you look at the top, and there's this man riding on the top of the skull on a horse. And that's because it is about the Marshcope Bone Wars back in the 1800s. So a young Philadelphia ne'er-do-well is dared to join an expedition out west to go find bones, and he does. This was finished by Crichton's wife. The first signs of this were in about 1974. It weaved in and out. Who knows who really wrote it, but if you want to escape into the Wild West and you want a little bit of crazy Crichton, this does it.
This works now.
Yeah, Dragon Teeth.
Brilliant.
Othniel Seamarsh, Doug. He did a great monograph for the government published in the 19th century on Dinocerta that had all these incredible folding plates of fossils. It's a great collector's item.
Great. Okay, you are up, my friend.
We're going to poetry, Doug.
Yes, good, as you always do.
Well, yeah, we need poetry. Always works for me.
Yeah.
Paisley Rechdel was recently named the newest Utah Poet Laureate in a fine long stream of them that began with David Lee and Kenneth Brower and Catherine Coles.
Yes.
Her new book, I think Betsy had her for a reading,
we
didn't
did.
She, recently?
Wonderful.
Imaginary Vessels. I'm going to read one short poem from it to get us started here. It's called Self-Portrait as Mae West One-Liner. Now, I am not going to attempt to explain, nor could I, the author's obsession with Mae West, but it permeates this book. Mae West, I think of as a voluptuous, somewhat hammy actress of a long time ago, but also being the river runner I am, when I started running rivers, you wore Mae West life jackets, and they were named after her because they were very big and poofy in the front. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Self-portrait as Mae West one-liner. I'm no moaning bluet, mountable linnet, mumbling nun. I'm tangible, I'm gin, able to molt in toto to limb. I'm blame and angle, I'm lumbago, an oblate mug gone notable, not glum. I'm a taboo tuba mogul, I'm motile, I'm nimble. No gab enui, no bagel bun boat. I'm one big megaton bolt able to bail men out. Gluten I am, male bong unit. I'm a genial bum, mental obi genital montage. I'm agent limbo, my blunt bio an amulet, an enigma. Omit Elon, omit bingo. Alien mango, I'm glib lingo. Untangle me, Tangelo, but I'm no angel. Imaginary Vessels by Paisley Rechdel.
Wow. That's so great.
I know.
Speaking of poets, we really have great poets. The very first Utah poet laureate, David Lee, recently read it at my shop along with Nancy Takas, and both of them have new books out. Dave's is quite a title. It's called Blue Bonnets, Fire Wheels, and Brown-Eyed Susans, or Poems New and Used from the Bandera Rag and Bone Shop. And it's really an autobiographical look at David Lee's roots in Texas. We think of him as the pig poet of Paraguna, but he's really, his roots are in Texas, and this novel, or this volume of poems, really shows his roots. And then quickly, The Worrier, poems by Nancy Taukus. She's a Wellington, Utah poet and a fine, fine poet, and this is a beautiful new contribution by her. And lastly, Wendell Berry's got a new collection out called A Small Porch. And also there's a brand new edition of The Unsettling America, his magnus opus, yeah. Essays, not poetry.
Yeah. There's a decent documentary about Wendell Berry that we talked about recently.
So yes.
It was on my mind. I'm surprised you didn't read from him. I'm not asking you to. We need to move on.
Wendell Berry is wonderful.
No kidding. Betsy Burton.
Okay, I'm going to start with some novels. And usually I start with what's literary, but it's summer, right? So I'm going to start with what's fun. Not that it isn't literary, but it's fun. So the first one is The Golden Hill by Frances Spufford. And a word of warning, this isn't out yet. It will be in 2 weeks, but it's the perfect summer read. It's set in New York City circa 1744, so the revolution hasn't quite happened, but we all know it's about to, except characters in the book, of course. And a young man leaps off a ship at the pier, runs up a hill to this counting house, which is a financial institution, with a kind of letter of credit and presents it. And the guy in the counting house thinks, well, this will founder our firm if it's for real, but maybe it isn't. Who is this guy? And so the book takes place in the period of time when they're trying to figure out if he's valid and what this is about. He comes from a very old-line New York family, has two daughters, one of whom is sort of a typical the other sister, Jane Austen character, the sweet sister, the other one who is, excuse the French here, a bitch. And she is the one, of course, who is our heroine and who falls for, well, I don't want to give that away. It's just a romp of a read. It reads like Tom Jones. It's fun. It's funny. It got rave reviews in England. The Guardian raved about it. I think maybe it was a bestseller there, and I just can't recommend it highly enough. Golden Hill by Frances Spufford, guaranteed to put you in a good mood and keep you entertained.
Great.
The next one is The Widow Nash by Jamie Harrison, the daughter of Jim Harrison, who wrote some wonderful mysteries a while back and now has written this kind of almost gothic and totally entertaining book. The main character, Dulcie, is the daughter and sort of dog's body of this miner who has had gold mines all over the world and just lost a fortune. Claims he lost it, but did he lose it? He's half mad. He's syphilitic. She's trying to help him. And she has an ex-fiancé who really wants that gold. And Dulcie wonders what's going to happen to her when her dad dies. So she takes off. And she winds up in the wilds of Montana, but always with the specter of this guy out there coming for her. Just a great read. She's a wonderful writer. I can't believe she's been quiet for so many years. The Widow Nash, Jamie Harrison. And then a mystery, Earthly Remains by Donna Leon. I say on this program over and over again, she's like liquid heroin, and she is. Commissario Guido Brunetti is her main character. He's a cynic. He works in a very correct system. And in this book, he's had it. This is a midlife crisis of huge proportions. He thinks he's had a heart attack. It's anxiety. So he goes off to an island by himself, starts to row with an old guy who was a friend of his father's, trying to regain his sanity. And this old guy is into honeybees and ecology. He's a fascinating character, and someone kills him. And so our Commissario Guido Brunetti has a reason to live. He wants to find the killer. Then finally one.
Say the name of it again. It's
Earthly Remains Earthly by Donna Leon. And then one other mystery, Persons Unknown, again not out yet but coming probably in a week, Persons Unknown by Susie Steiner, who also wrote a book new in paper, Missing Presumed. This is a kick of a main character. She's British. She's really hardcore as a cop, but she's really just mixed up as a human being. Can't find someone to love. Tries these silly, disastrous things in the first book. In the second book, she has adopted a kid from the inner city, and thinking she's doing him a favor, she takes him to a small town and takes a job as a cop there. And it's what happens to him, to her. She's pregnant. We won't even talk about who the father is. And their lives over about a period of a couple of weeks, and it's just hard to put down. Missing Presumed was her first one. Persons Unknown is her second one. Susie Steiner.
Coming out in about a week.
Yeah.
It's Betsy Burton. She is with, of course, the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th. Ken Sanders is with us. to his shop, Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. And Catherine Weller is with us, of course, from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square in Salt Lake. A list of the books we talked about, even the ones we won't get to, because we won't get to many of them, will be available on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're sitting here talking about more books because that's what we're doing today. Of course, this is our summer book show. That's what we call it, where we gather our panel of experts, local booksellers, who also read a lot to give you some suggestions for your summer vacation, wherever you might be going. Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks, and Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop. Round three. Kat, you're up.
All right, my next book is called Where the Water Goes by David Owen. David Owen is a New Yorker writer who has written many environmentally tinged pieces in the past. This one is specifically about the Colorado River, which is not a very large river, and it's not a very long river, but its impact is enormous here in the West, absolutely enormous. Mm. It creates water for 7 states, and we use it all up. All the time. And this book is about what happens there. But it's not just a water policy book. It's also a bit of a travelogue and a tour through the West as a man visits places along the Colorado River, much like Ellen Molloy did in Last Cheetah's Waltz when she traced the Colorado from its heads down to Mexico where it dries up. David does the same thing, and he has his own unique take on it. There are a lot of people who call this an update for Cadillac Desert, maybe Cadillac Desert 2.0. Hmm. It's not quite that. I think it's a little bit too personal, and he's not really comfortable entirely with the political or with speaking about solutions necessarily. However, it is a fascinating read, and we've got a clip here of when he really began to encounter the West in a real way as a young man and get those first hints of what water in the West means.
This is read by the actor Fred Sanders.
In 1976, when I was 21, I spent the summer living in a rented house in Colorado Springs and working on the grounds crew of an apartment complex on what was then the outskirts of the city. During most of the week, my co-workers and I moved hoses and sprinklers around the property to keep the grass green, and then we mowed what we had grown. We had to be at work at 6:30, but weren't allowed to begin mowing until 7, to allow the residents to sleep in. So for the first half hour, we devised alternative methods of waking them up, such as slowly dragging shovels across parking lots. Watering was like a race. The grass began to turn brown almost the moment we moved our sprinklers, partly because we were a mile above sea level in what is essentially a desert, and partly because the apartment complex had been built on porous ground on the site of an old quarry. One night I dreamed that one of the Rainbird rotary sprinklers we used at work was keeping me awake by rhythmically spraying me in bed, and I made a mental note to ask my housemate not to water my room while I was trying to sleep. Among the many questions I failed to ask myself that summer was where all the water we used at work came from. All I knew was that every time I attached a hose to a spigot and turned it on, I could run it full force until it was time to go home.
Boy, is that a issue we probably are all thinking about right now.
Yeah, we're all very familiar with that sense of just watering and watering and watering, and the grass still turns brown. It was John Wesley Powell who originally said, there is not sufficient water to supply these lands. And he was right. We have fought that ever since to our now possible harm. However, Owen is not that pessimistic about it. He thinks because it must be solved, it will be solved. He's just a fascinating man, and this is a fun book. There are parts of it, such as where he goes to a place called Quartzsite, Arizona, which is a campsite, a big, big campsite for people who basically live in RVs, and talks with the elderly people there. He muses that the internet and the World Wide Web are great things for elderly people who are camping in the middle of nowhere with things on their minds. it's a terrific book, Where the Water Goes by David Owen.
Great. Betsy Burton.
Okay, as promised now, the literary novels, and there are some incredible ones this year. The first one I want to talk about is The House of Names by Colm Tobin. I think that's how you say his name. Irish, wrote Brooklyn, wrote The Master. He's a wonderful writer, and he's turned his talent to something very different. The story of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra and Orestes and Electra that we all know from Greek drama and certainly not from contemporary fiction very often. What he does with these characters is absolutely amazing. You know, Clytemnestra goes with her daughter thinking that her daughter is going to be married to Achilles and really she's going to be sacrificed. And her rage, her murderous rage at this is so understandable in this book that if you had a knife, you would do it for her. So this raging character is sympathetic in the sense that she did what she should do. And then Orestes, because she does kill Agamemnon, of course, Orestes, who kills her, is also a sympathetic character. He's a young man torn between his mother, between his sister, who wants to get even with his mother, a man that he's really fallen for. He's just torn in pieces, and he just wants to be loved, if you can believe that, of Orestes. It's absolutely a brilliant book, House of Names by Colm Tobin. Then, on a very different note, Elizabeth Strout, Anything is Possible. This is short stories, and I tend not to like short stories. I like to fall into a novel. But each story is brilliant. Together, collectively, they form a network that is even more brilliant. You find out you have this perfect short story that's very dramatic in its own right. And then three stories later, you learn something that gives a new layer to what you've read in that story. And by the end, all of the characters in this town, the same town that was portrayed in Olive Kittredge, everything is tied together. And the brilliance of how she unlayers everything is just mind-bending. She's funny. She's a plain writer like Kent Hariff, and she's one of our best writers.
Say the name again.
The Anything is Possible, Elizabeth Strout. And then the last one I want to talk about, again, very literary, not an easy novel, is The Ministry of Utmost Happiness by Arundhati Roy. She wrote The God of Small Things. She won the Booker for it. That was a very easy novel. I mean, it wasn't easy emotionally, but it was easy to read. This is sort of the opposite. One of the main characters, there are two, is a transvestite. And she doesn't have an easy life in India. She lives with a group of people like her, but she longs for something and finally sees a girl, a little girl that she wants to rescue and mother. So she's one of the main characters. The other is a young woman. Three men are in love with this woman. One is from Kashmir. One is part of the establishment there is Brahmin, and one is a journalist who covers all the world. So you learn all about the history of what's happening in Kashmir, what was happening back then, and she too finds a young child that she wants to adopt. And so it's about motherhood in a profound way. These two women come together. The men are fascinating characters, and once the three men are introduced into the book, it becomes a very quick read in a way that it isn't in the first half. But it is the weaving together of all of the parts of this, and in the act, all of the parts of India that is so fascinating. This is a staggering work, but as I said, it's perhaps flawed and not easy work to read. It is the most it is the most literary of all. It's the one that probably will live on, although I do think that House of Names will as well. And actually, I think Elizabeth Strout
will. They all will.
They all will. They're wonderful.
Say the name of this one again.
Okay, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, Arundhati Roy.
Great. Betsy, thanks. Ken Sanders.
Well, Doug, I bet you thought we were done with the Mountain Meadow Massacre.
I didn't think we were done, actually. But keep going.
Rick Turley, the lead author of the previous book on the Mountain Meadow Massacre, to the answer book, if you will, to Will Bagley's Blood of the Prophets, has spent the last decade compiling from
his attorney. He's the church historian for the
assistant church historian, I think, is his current title. So he is the author of these gigantic, enormous things. these two monstrous tomes called Mountain Meadow Massacre, Collected Legal Papers, Volume 1, Initial Investigations and Indictments, Volume 2, Selected Trial Records and Aftermath. Clearly, this will be a reference work to go to on the Mountain Meadow Massacre.
But it's just that. He doesn't process it?
It's just there's a brief introduction that sets up what they're trying to do. But it's back to the old argument. You know, I don't believe there's any faith-believing Mormon that will ever believe that Brigham Young knew about or caused the Mountain Meadow Massacre, and there's no Gentile that thinks otherwise. And part of the argument, yes, I believe Rick Turley. I know Rick Turley. I respect him as a historian. Yes, he's collected every legal document that exists, but all the pertinent legal documents and the diaries and the journals from that time period have been disappeared in the 19th century. So I don't disbelieve Rick, but we're never going to know because we don't have the documents.
Got it.
Enough said about Mount Meadow
Massacre.
And
are you sure you want to recommend those?
Yes, I do, because you're not going to get this kind of compilation of firsthand sources of the investigations in the 19th century on the Mountain Meadow Massacre from any other work. So, yes, I do recommend it.
Okay,
with reservations.
Yeah.
and my own opinions.
Right.
I want to go back to Body Horror, Anne Elizabeth Moore's book. Again, men, what's it about? And I couldn't – so just some of the chapters. The Shameful Legacy and Secret Promise of the Sanitary Napkin Disposal Bag. A Few Things I've Learned About Illness in America. On Leaving the Birthplace of Standard Time. Superbugs Are Coming for You. Fake Snake Oil. Effin Cancer, after Susan Sontag, The Metaphysics of Compost, 3 months about emerging from your deathbed. It really is, in Sontag's word, illness is metaphor, but she takes this to a whole new level. And as a male speaking, reading her accounts of illness and how she's treated by the rest of the medical world, which is largely male doctors, is horrifying, and we're guilty. So that's what I want to say about that. Then I have to go back to the Colorado River.
Oh, I wish you would. Let's talk more about it.
if we want to talk, okay, fine, for this New Yorker guy writing a book about the Colorado River. Well, what does he know? Fine. It's a great personal journey. So, yeah, mm-hmm. Ellen Molloy did it. So did Ann Zinger in Run, River, mm-hmm. Run many decades ago. And you alluded to Powell in his two great reports, the first guy to run the whole length of those two rivers in his exploration of the Colorado River in 1869, and his follow-up that gets to the heart of water use issues in the West, land of the arid regions. Mm-hmm. If you want to really know the Colorado history, read Frank Waters, The Colorado. Mm-hmm. If you want to understand water in the West, read Charles Bowden's Killing the Hidden Waters, or read Craig Childs' The Secret Knowledge of Water.
There's going to be a rebuttal to your suggestion.
No, but he's right on. I mean,
don't
this
get him started.
Not
these are books we love.
Exactly.
But this that doesn't mean there aren't good new ones.
No, it doesn't mean that it isn't good. It doesn't mean it's not a new version. But that doesn't negate all of the wonderful things that Ken has cited. And I would add to that Fradkin, Stegner. Cadillac Desert.
Yeah, River No More.
But that's why I say it's not Cadillac Desert 2.0. It's its own animal.
You mentioned Rick Turley, who I'm reminded is the director of LDS Church Public Affairs. Mm.
Right. They shifted his job on him.
Okay. Ken Sanders, thanks. And thanks for all of that, you guys. Okay, so we're going to take another quick break. Betsy Burton, of course, is with the King's English Bookshop. Ken Sanders is with Ken Sanders Rare Books. Catherine Weller is with Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. And all of these books that we've talked about, even the ones we didn't get to, will be on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back for some more titles in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our summer book show with Betsy Burton, Ken Sanders, and Catherine Weller. We have a children's round now. Let's see. Betsy, you're going to get things started.
Yes.
Part of the reason I like the Denys Lehane is I love strong women. And this book is called Rad Women Worldwide, and it is fabulous. It has this strong graphic piece to it, as you can see. And the women really come from all over the world, as you can see, and all over history. And there are just some really interesting picks. One of the things that I loved here was the guerrilla women. It came from a misunderstanding of the word guerrilla. They thought, well, it sounds the same, right? Let's dress up as guerrillas and change the world, which they are quickly doing. My favorite, perhaps, you know, they cover Frida Kahlo and all these other people. But Josephine Baker was the most fascinating woman you will ever meet in the annals of history. She was a spy, an incredible dancer, Parisian, adopted 12 kids, her rainbow family, changed the world 1,000 times in 1,000 ways. And I love the thought of young kids reading this book and looking at these people as role models.
Who wrote it?
There's an illustrator, Miriam Kleinstahl, and an author, Katie Schatz. They were both at the store, and they were fabulous.
Name again? It's just
Rad Women Worldwide.
Good title.
Go, that's great. Okay, so just quickly, Drew DeWalt and the illustrator Adam Rex, the legend of rock, paper, scissors. We all know the game, right? Well, this presupposes that the backyard is a fantasy land where rock reigns, and the office one where paper reigns, and the kitchen one where scissors reign, and the three have a mighty conflict. I won't tell you what happens.
Great.
Well, you may know. And A Perfect Day by Lane Smith. This is perfect summer book, very whimsical in terms of the art, about a perfect day in which everybody's happy until the bear comes along and takes everything. And it's quite whimsical and funny, but we find out that Lane Smith has just such a bear living right outside his window. A Perfect Day, Lane Smith.
Catherine.
All right, I'm going to take just a second to shout out on the first book, Rad American Women A to Z, which is
right.
Same layout, yep. American Women. Fantastic.
Right.
I'm going to start with the book 789, which is written by Tara Lazar and illustrated by Ross McDonald. It is a hard-boiled detective picture book. Starting with, six has a problem. Everyone knows that seven is always after him. Word on the street is that 789. It's true that six's days are numbered. Lucky for him, Private Eye is on the case. But the facts just don't add up. So it's a great book about numbers. It's whimsical, fun, and funny. Todd Lazar, 789. Next is the Very Strange and Lovely Spork by Kyo McClear. This is a great book for blended families. It's also really pretty because of its limited palette. But it's about this poor spork. He's not a fork, nor is he a spoon. He doesn't know how he fits in the silverware drawer. He tries wearing a hat, and the forks shun him. He wears a crown, and the spoons shun him. He doesn't know what to do. And then one day, a very strange thing comes into the house, and Fork's purpose becomes known. The very strange thing is the one thing that knows what to do with Spork, and that thing is a baby. Next is I Promise, a picture book by David McPhail, who is so old-fashioned, and I am a sentimental sucker, so I love him, just love him. This is just a soft, gentle story about a baby bear walking with his mother through the woods and asking about promises and making promises to each other, about trying to be good and loving one another and singing to one another. It's heartwarming and lovely. I Promise by David McPhail.
Mr. Sanders.
Well, Doug, I have two grandchildren, Flynn and Lyra, and Lyra in particular is really getting into reading books these days, and I've just said there's nothing new here, but I've really discovered that there's dozens and dozens of different collections of Disney films and storybooks and everything. And yeah, a lot of the Disney films and a lot of the Disney books are about princesses. And almost all the princesses are white princesses and fairy tales. But the whole world of Disney is much more complex and better than that. And a way to wean her away from the princesses and into other Disney motifs is through all of these Disney storybooks. So I've been giving them to Lyra, and she loves them. Moana, I know it's a movie, but it's also a little golden book.
Is it? Is that right?
It is, yes. Well, hey, it's a Disney franchise. You think they're not going to make a book out of it? Coffee mugs, what? No, well, maybe not coffee mugs for kids. Who knows? Anyhow, Moana the movie is just, it's about female empowerment. And for the first time, and I've seen this movie several times now, it's about a princess that is of color, not a white princess. And she's kind of a kick-butt princess. She sails an outrigger, you know, raft to almost entirely around the world, and she puts up with a really obnoxious demigod and kind of keeps him in his place, too. So I think it's a wonderful female empowerment thing for young girls everywhere. And then lastly, my son Flynn is really into mythology, and these Perry Jackson books by Rick Riordan about Olympian gods and fantasy, he has blown through this entire five-book series, and Riordan has written many others as well.
My son Charlie recommend
this
a lot.
Percy Jackson by Rick Riordan.
Absolutely. Okay. We have time for a lightning round.
All
Holy
right.
mackerel. Can I just remind you, lightning round? So be quick. Let's like say briefly.
What?
Elaine is like, just remember, only say the title, but be quick. You can say something more than that. But
all right. Okay. So I'm going to start with the long haul Finn Murphy. He is a truck driver, and he drives moving vans and does so for 30 years. He's a great writer. There's some of the funniest stories in here you'll ever want to read, and you see America. The Radium Girls, another nonfiction. This is the girls who worked with radium before World War I, tasting the brushes and then and what happened to their teeth and their jaws and their lives and the companies that wouldn't acknowledge what was happening. It's chilling but amazing to read. And then between them, Richard Ford, he writes a biography of both of his parents. You learn about the time, about them, and about Rick Ford.
Between them. Yep.
Right.
Okay.
Right. The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time by Brooke Gladstone, who you'll remember is the co-host of On the Media from WNYC. This was an outpouring of the soul. It's a big, beautiful, long essay about media and interpreting reality these days. And
she mentions Aldous Huxley and Orwell, too.
Yeah.
We just interviewed her yesterday, by the way. I'll mention she's going to be on the show Friday or Monday. We're not quite sure yet.
Wonderful. So, listen to that and then read this because it's great. Gem and Dixie by Sarah Zarr, our wonderful young adult author who is so good. She can write literary adult books, and maybe she will someday. Wonderful book about two girls whose parents cannot raise them. They're not capable of it, and how these girls raise themselves and what it means to break away.
Go for it.
Brooke Williams' Open Midnight, Where Ancestors and Wilderness Meet, a rumination on his own great-great-grandfather, I believe. A new volume of the dead poet Charles Bukowski on love. And finally, Granada, A Pomegranate in the Hand of God, a brilliant new novel by Stephen Nightingale.
Well, if your phone's going to go off, it's perfect to do it at the end, Kat. That's absolutely nothing wrong with that as we're finished. And I should say that the titles we didn't get to will be on our website, radiowest.org. Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop. Thank you all.
Thank you, Doug.
Again, for being with us. To see a complete list again, go to our website. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Zoe Wolf McGinn and Kelsey Moore, who's been videotaping, by the way. We're doing a Facebook Live. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program, of course, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.